When Lopa Cha's physical condition was found deteriorating and not physically active anymore, how did the Sangha and lay community react to it? And yourself, how did you feel about it? Also, how did the Sangha manage to find ways to organize a new leadership? Any challenges, confusions, conflicts? Oh, tons of challenges, confusion, and conflict. I mean, that was to be expected. But anyway, yeah, when his, despite the fact that Ajahn Chah, very much a part of his teaching was everything's impermanent, everything's uncertain. Everything is changing. Especially this physical body, and he was also quite forthcoming about his own. I mean, he could recognize the deterioration that was happening, and he was quite, and there was a particular period where it was unraveling fairly quickly, and he actually said to us as a Sangha that this is not a medical condition that the doctors can cure. This is a karmic condition. I'm going to continue to deteriorate, and I'm not going to be able to help myself. You are going to have to help look after me for some time. And he said for some time was, I don't think anybody thought it was going to be 10 years, which is what it ended up being. But he was pretty clear in letting us know what that was, and that we would need to rise up as a Sangha. And also that's something that Ajahn Chah, in his method of leadership, he really tried to include people and not just keep all of the decisions and power to himself or make himself the sole leader. He would do a lot of delegation and consulting, and he placed a tremendous emphasis on Sangha people who would help to make a major decision. So that's Ajahn Chah, really included Sangha, and then with his when he was not physically, he was deteriorating very quickly, then of course there was a tremendous amount of grief, and certainly that's what I felt as well, a tremendous amount of grief. And sometimes I was asked not that long ago, oh, when Ajahn Chah died, did you feel a lot of grief? And I said, no. And so people were taken aback. Why not? Says, I did my grieving when he was still alive and was sick, and there's this slow separation, so that when he did pass away, then I felt ready for that. And I think that happened with probably a vast majority of the others, is that that certainty of separation was there because he wasn't, it was obvious he was not going to get better. And so that, you know, we could do our grieving then. And of course, grief affects people in different ways, so that it's not everybody, whether Sangha or lay, reacted to it skillfully. There were certainly those who, say, left the community. Wat Bapong was pretty small community for quite a while. In those first several years, 4, 5, 6 years after Ajahn Chah first got really ill, nowadays Ajahn Lumpa Liam is incredibly respected and accepted, but at that point in time when Ajahn Chah was first ill, Lumpa Liam was sort of like, he's not Ajahn Chah. And everybody was grumbling and complaining. He's not doing it like Ajahn Chah. And of course he's not. He's Lumpa Liam. there were many who were disaffected and left or went off to branch monasteries to be in the orbit still, but what one of the things that held the Sangha together really and built the Sangha that we still reap the fruits of today is because of Ajahn Chah's need to be looked after, then at Wat Bapong we set up a system of nursing Ajahn Chah, and so that there was always 4 monks and a novice looking after him in the daytime, 4 monks and a novice looking after him at night, and most days there would be a nurse, a male nurse from the local government hospital. Who was the Ajahn Chah became he was already a patient of the Queen's. So he got there was a team coming out from the hospital every single day to check on Ajahn Chah and to provide any medicines and treatment that were needed. And then, of course, the Mechis at Wat Bapong took over looking after all the kind of the food and diet and whatnot, so that everybody was involved in his care, and also very quickly, people came forward and helped to. Build a hospital kuti for him, and we used that all the way through up until he passed away. But that, and every 2 weeks, they would change the shifts of people. Anybody had the opportunity to come from the branch monasteries. Volunteer to help look after Ajahn Chah. And there'd be a lineup, really. They always had one very experienced monk as kind of like the head nurse attendant or head attendant. Another monk who would be quite experienced. And then it could have two who were not experienced and could help out and plug in and learn how to look after Ajahn Chah, so that there was this constant rota for taking care of Ajahn Chah. And of course, the branch monks, sometimes the senior monks would be there. Yes, most often it was more junior monks. But say, Ajahn Yanarato, you did many of shifts looking after Ajahn Chah. Just one. I'm surprised. But yeah, certainly the there was always, and his care was, there was a lot of attention put on his care, so that he was bedridden for 10 years, basically, 9-10 years that he was bedridden, and he never had a bed sore. Just that level of attention was really quite exceptional. So it really helped to draw this the Sangha together. And so the people really rose to the occasion, and I think that really helped to cement the, because that, you know, really Ajahn Chah's legacy is Sangha, is community. And so that was a that period of time of looking after him was a quite a natural time to to start to see who's, you know, so like, or that's because the question, how did the Sangha manage to find a way to organize a new leadership? It was an organic process of people. You find, you realize different monks step up and different leaders start to manifest, and a certain confidence is kind of grows, and others will shrink back. Because some it was just too intimidating to look after Ajahn Chah, or just didn't put the effort in to do it. So the different people rose to the occasion, other people fell away. So it was quite a natural time for leadership to grow and communication to start to develop in the Sangha. So of course there were a whole variety of challenges, but it was because of the real need to look after Ajahn Chah, then there wasn't a whole lot of confusion. Certainly some conflicts, but personally, people were always willing to set aside their personal conflict to look after Ajahn Chah and look after Wat Pa Pong. So that and doing that for 8, 9, 10 years. Then that there was a continuity, and again, where this then Ajahn Chah's legacy being Sangha, and legacy being his teaching and commitment to teaching and training, so that when the as it was becoming, you know, very obvious, he's not, because, you know, there was a certain amount of denial, you know, our hope that he would somehow magically recuperate, as people more and more accepted the reality that was not going to be the case, then we could start to get our minds around preparing for for his passing. And that's when we started to do these kind of mini practice sessions on special days, so that we get used to having gatherings of people and having to do that. And when we first floated the idea of getting ready to, you know, making real preparation, there was a fair bit of resistance, but then what we did was, because for say myself and Lumpa Liam were we because we were the closest to what was actually happening on the ground with Lumpa and looking at the place, and then it was obvious that Wat Bapong at that point was not ready to host an event like Ajahn Chah's cremation. It just didn't have the infrastructure to. And so, but it is a touchy thing for because if you start doing too much preparation, and there's this superstition that you're hastening his death, so there was some resistance. So what we did was invited. We took about 10 abbots of the senior disciples of Ajahn Chah, that had a strong voice in the community. We went up and attended one of the cremations of the Lumpu Mun disciples, and we got there, and you know, lots and lots of people, minimal organization, maximum chaos, and it was a perfect way to sort of say, we've got to do it differently than this. so then we got a clear, like a green light to really start preparation. Many of the elders did balk when we started drawing up plans for the cremation pyre, and we had to stop because there was so much resistance, both amongst the lay people but for say Lumpa Liam and myself and Jan and Ake, Lumpa Jan, this was the most practical thing: get as much done as possible while you're ahead of time. But that we couldn't do. So when Lopo Cha passed away, then we had a year to get everything done. We had, and we had to build this, draw up the plans and build the jetty that was going to be his cremation pyre. So what you see is that big jetty. That was a major project that was done very quickly. But I think that sense of just working together to look after Ajahn Chah, that really helped to cement the leadership of Wat Bapong, and it also, you know, started to see who had some skills, who was willing to set aside their personal agendas and really give themselves to helping out. Gosh, that's only the first question. But, you know, I think one of the catalyst was the faith that everybody had in Ajahn Chah and wanting to do right by his example, and his life needed a response. It was was setting aside any personal challenges, confusions, and conflicts, and doing the right thing. Because that is how Ajahn Chah lived his life. I mean, he didn't. That was one of the things that, you know, his example was always an example of doing what was and giving himself to what was a benefit to the Dhamma, to the Vinaya, to others. And there was so little personal agenda and personal kind of preferences ever shown for himself. That was his example, inspiring example.